Pennsylvania is relying on landowners to create habitat for birds and bats and keep their land out of development.
I said, at least when we're dead and gone, nobody can do it. So now it stays like this for forever.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the landowners on the front lines of conservation. Plus, the job perks of an energy efficiency expert.
I get to actually see the difference that it's made in their home, and I know that that's going to save them money, make their home more comfortable, but it's also going to reduce that home's reliance on fossil fuels.
And an advocate for one of Western Pennsylvania's most abundant resources tells us why it deserves more national attention.
The rivers were the highways. The trail, as it were, is the rivers. It's a water trail.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Newly released emails show White House and EPA officials tried to stop the public from seeing a federal report on a toxic chemical that's polluting water supplies nationwide. The chemical in question was used in nonstick cookware and firefighting foam at military installations. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips has more.
A string of emails among White House, EPA, and Department of Defense officials show concern that new research on a group of chemicals known as PFAS are more dangerous than previously acknowledged by the EPA. The officials refer to the report as a, quote, public relations nightmare. Public health researchers at the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, a division of the Department of Health and Human Services, drafted the report. Yogan Kithari is with the Union of Concerned Scientists, which got the emails through the Freedom of Information Act. Kithari says the emails are another example of how the Trump administration tries to block science.
When it comes to inconvenient information or facts, whether it's related to climate change, whether it's related to chemical safety, etc., they try their best to sideline and ignore the science.
The military used the chemical in firefighting foam, which has led to drinking water contamination in Bucks and Montgomery counties. The EPA plans a summit on the chemical next week to make sure the federal government responds in what it calls a, quote, uniform way. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Bats and songbirds are in trouble in Pennsylvania. So the government has turned to private landowners to protect their habitat. More than 70% of land in Pennsylvania is privately owned. Each year, about 400 landowners manage their property for threatened and endangered species. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited one family in Blair County and has their story.
To find Tom Belinda's house in Williamsburg near Altoona, you wind through a small community of homes and fields along the river valley and up a nearly 2-mile-long gravel driveway. Finally, the woods break open to a clearing and a mountain lodge home that's made of logs. After a wet greeting from two black Newfoundlands,
this one might lick you to death.
Belinda leads me to the second-story deck, which looks out over his 1,300-acre wooded valley.
Yep, I never want to leave the mountain, man. I'll tell you.
He's a forester and a hunter wearing a ball cap and camouflage pants, and he quickly spots deer in the distance.
See him walking in the woods to the left?
Oh, yeah. I see.
There's three of them. There's another little one.
Belinda and his wife bought this property 20 years ago when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contacted him about managing his land to improve habitat for endangered Indiana bats. He laughed. He points to the eaves under his roof. He was already providing them habitat.
And I'm like, yeah, you guys want me to manage all this stuff for the woods. And I said, you can just come up underneath my poles of my house and I can show them right where they're at it every day.
But as he looked into it, Belinda says managing his land for bat habitat made sense. He's surrounded by state game lands and other private property, much of it part of a corridor of nearly 21,000 acres of protected bat habitat. And then there's the bat cave. He points out from his deck at the cave where these tiny mouse-eared bats, weighing as little as 3 pennies, hibernate in the winter.
Which you can see over there past that red topped house, there's Canoe Creek Lake over there, and there's an actual well-known bat habernacula that where they go in the wintertime.
According to the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a branch of the USDA, a 2015 survey of that bat cave found the number of bats had dropped from 32,000 to just 70. Indiana bats have suffered from habitat loss and white nose syndrome and are listed under the Endangered Species Act. Belinda saw an opportunity to help and to secure the future of his property.
I looked at my wife one day and I said, are we ever going to put any buildings? We're never going to develop this. She's like, heck no. And I'm like, then why not just put it in this program? I said, at least when we're dead and gone, nobody can do it. So now it stays like this for forever.
Belinda put more than half his property into a conservation easement, which means the land can never be developed, even if it's sold. He gets tax breaks for that. He takes me out in a small off-road vehicle to look at how he's managed the land for bats over the past 5 years. We drive down some rocky pathways into the valley to a spot where he's trying to get the trees to grow bigger.
Yep, see, this is the bat area.
In summer, as many as 100 females form colonies in older, larger trees like hickory and ash, where they crawl underneath the warm, shaggy bark to roost. Each raises only one pup a season. This is why Belinda has cleared smaller trees in this area and points to a larger one that remains.
We're going to try to grow it quicker, at a quicker state, quicker than what it normally would. The only way to do that is to remove all the competition.
We head to another spot. In recent years, Belinda has started managing an additional 55 acres specifically for a small blue migratory songbird, the Cerulean warbler. They're known to breed in heavily wooded Appalachian forests. The population of Ceruleans dropped 70% over the last 50 years. Belinda is trying to recreate lost Cerulean habitat, a mix of large trees and a robust understory. That means creating gaps in the forest canopy to allow sunlight in and smaller plants to grow. We stop along the path on one side.
Look down here. It's all shaded.
The trees are tightly packed together. There's not much growing on the forest floor. Last year, Belinda removed many trees on the other side of this path, making gaps in the overhead tree canopy.
And if you look up through there, this is a nice, beautiful night to see this, because see the sunlight? Every one of those sun holes, those sunbeam holes, is going to grow something.
Belinda wants that sunshine to help the bushes and grapevines grow. They attract insects that Ceruleans like. But there's still a problem. Invasive species. Plants like multiflora rose and especially Japanese barberry. These are ornamentals people buy to look pretty in their yards.
This is what it turns into.
We're looking at a thick mass of barberry, a woody shrub covering the forest floor.
Yeah, look, there's nothing can grow. That's all nasty stuff that needs to go.
So Belinda spends a lot of time and money spraying pesticides to get rid of them. The Natural Resources Conservation Service shares his costs. Last year, the agency paid Pennsylvania landowners nearly $250,000 to remove invasives. As the sun goes down, we head back to his house and look out over the deck. One by one, a few small bats slip out from the woodwork and into the night.
There's another one. See it? See, that came out right here.
Belinda says they're headed down the valley toward the river to eat insects. His government partners say efforts by private land stewards like Belinda are giving the bats and warblers a chance to survive in the forests of Pennsylvania. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
People who work in energy efficiency see how the wind blows through cracks in a house and work to fix it. But what if this happened on a bigger scale? Whole neighborhoods.
I want to make these old, dilapidated Pittsburgh homes as energy efficient as possible.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we hear from an energy efficiency expert on her work and her dream. Stay tuned. Those invasive barberry shrubs that have gone wild on Tom Belinda's property, they're a problem all over Pennsylvania. I bet you've seen one in a neighbor's yard. In the spring, people are visiting nurseries and choosing these plants for landscaping. Last summer, I spoke with some scientists about this all-too-common shrub that's bad news for the health of forests, and people, too. It would definitely be an understatement to say that Ryan Utes is not a fan of Japanese barberry.
This is what we call barberry hell. That's going to be all that you see.
Utes is a professor at Chatham University's Falk School of Sustainability, and we're walking through some damp, forested land on the property of their Eden Hall campus north of Pittsburgh. He has some other choice words for the thorny, shoulder-high shrubs all along the tree line. He calls them insidious and alarming. That's because of what's beyond the wall of Barberry.
We have a nice population of mature oaks, cherries, and red maples here, but based on our research, everywhere you see Barberry, which as you can see right now is pretty much everywhere, there are no young trees underneath it.
Utes and some of his students, like Art Link, have noticed that even a small patch of Japanese barberry can inhibit new generations of native trees.
Barberry grows very thick and very dense, and because of that, it can limit a lot of the resource of sunlight.
But barberry doesn't mind the shade. It's also not popular with deer grazing in woodlands, and it's not easy to get rid of. Japanese barberry was introduced from Asia as an ornamental. It has pretty spoon-shaped red leaves and berries. Seeds from the berries are dropped onto the forest floor or spread by birds. Weedy shoots of barberry can also root themselves into the ground, starting new plants. Young barberry is pulled out easily, but in their study plots, Utes and Link are dealing with more established, stubborn patches like this one, and they're using some barberry-busting tools you can buy at any home improvement store. Utes slices through the barberry stems with hedge trimmers, getting as close to the ground as possible.
See that yellow stem material? That's classic barberry. Bright, bright, bright yellow.
Then Art Link hooks up a propane tank, like the one on your backyard grill, to a small torch.
What I like to do is actually go around and get a 360 burn.
He slowly incinerates the cluster of barberry stems.
Usually I listen to music, and whenever the chorus comes on, I know when 30 seconds is up.
The plant smolders, but Link says he'll have to do it again. Barberry has been known to grow back even after it's been torched. So just how big a problem is barberry in Pennsylvania's forests?
It's quite a large problem, actually.
Kelly Sitch is an ecologist with the Pennsylvania Bureau of Forestry. He says not only does barberry muscle out native tree species, but it also makes an ideal home for mice, and by extension, the deer ticks they host, the ones that carry Lyme disease.
So in areas where barberry remains uncontrolled, researchers have found that the incidence of ticks per acre that are infected with Lyme disease is actually much higher than in areas where it's being controlled or where it's not present.
Sitch says each year, the state's foresters and biologists prioritize sections of land that are inundated with invasive species. And sometimes barberry makes it to the top of that list. They can use a combination of pulling it out mechanically if it doesn't disturb the soil too much, or scatter seeds, or apply herbicides to keep barberry from spreading. But Sitch agrees with Ryan Utes from Chatham when it comes to the best way to keep Japanese barberry out of Pennsylvania's forests.
Please don't buy barberry.
The Japanese variety, anyway. Although it's been banned in some states, many nurseries and big box stores still sell it for landscaping in Pennsylvania. Utes says there are other non-invasive species of barberry available, and he's a lot less prickly about those. To hear more stories in our Wild PA series about wildlife, like the Cerulean Warbler, and how species are being affected by energy, development, and just our own consumer choices, visit us at AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. There's more to come, too. I'm Carol Holsapple. This is the Allegheny Front. One thing you can do to save energy is to make your home more efficient. Across the United States, more than 2 million people work in energy efficiency. It's the largest sector of the nation's clean energy workforce. Virginia McGrath has held one of these jobs for 3 years. She's an energy auditor for Pittsburgh's Conservation Consultants Incorporated. And she says the conversation surrounding her work is changing.
I think that the energy efficiency field has made a transition. Instead of saving energy and saving money, we're talking about making a home safer and more comfortable. I think that that resonates with people a little bit more.
Lately, she spent a lot of time at a subdivision near Mars, a borough in Butler County. For State Impact Pennsylvania's Voices of Energy series, McGrath shares her story as she inspects a newly built house.
Hello. There's no one living in this home currently. They're closing, I believe, next week, Wednesday. The builders are having me come in to make sure that all of the energy efficiency installations that they've done are done well and that they didn't miss anything. Anywhere where wire or plumbing penetrations are coming in, they would want to be air sealed. So these should have a bead of caulk around them. I'm gonna just take a picture. And then you see how there's spray foam on this side, not on this side. So it's just little things like that that I'm looking for. This is just something I'm gonna note, and they might come back and do it, or they might not, we'll see. I really enjoy being able to see the difference that I'm making. So if I go to a home and do an energy audit and recommend that they get insulation or they do these air sealing measures, I get to actually see the difference that it's made in their home. And I know that that's going to save them money, make their home more comfortable, but it's also going to reduce that home's reliance on fossil fuels. So this is probably like a more awkward piece of equipment. This is the blower door. There's a test that I'm gonna do. It's an air leakage test. So I'll be sucking all the air out of the house and then being able to see where air leakage might be coming in. All right, we'll start it up. I guess to put this in perspective, this home is probably similar size to mine, and my house was built in 1900 though, and I do this for a living, so my house is pretty airtight and it's insulated pretty well, but my blower door reading is like 3200, so almost twice as much as this house. And that's just something it's really hard to get with the older homes, unless you're totally gutting them and redoing them yourself and redoing them with energy efficiency in mind. So I did recently start flipping houses. It's been an adventure. I want to put my knowledge that I have towards energy efficiency into these homes. And I want to make these old, dilapidated Pittsburgh homes as energy efficient as possible.
That was Virginia McGrath. Her story was produced by Amy Sisk for State Impact Pennsylvania. We'll be sharing more of these stories from the energy sector in coming weeks. And there's a link to the profiles at AlleghenyFront.org. For most people who remember their elementary school history, the Lewis and Clark expedition began over 200 years ago in Illinois. It continued as Captain Meriwether Lewis and his crew picked up William Clark in Missouri to explore the West and find new trade routes. That's not how the story begins for John McNulty.
I call it the golden stroll as you come up from the Duquesne Incline, you know, and come over this little knoll. There lies the West.
We're walking up a steep hill in Pittsburgh's Mount Washington neighborhood. And as we get to the top, the view is amazing. We see downtown Pittsburgh and the confluence where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers meet to form the Ohio. For McNulty, this is where the action began, and many people agree with him. The Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail commemorating their journey was established by Congress in 1978. It starts in Illinois, but there's a proposal to extend it eastward to Pittsburgh. John McNulty is a native Pittsburgher and an activist who belongs to multiple community groups. He's worked as an outdoor educator and now mostly supports himself as a musician and street performer. He's so passionate about Lewis and Clark, he quit his job in 2003 to join the bicentennial reenactment of the exploration. And he says this proposed trail extension has given him real purpose in life.
Give me the super short version of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
The Lewis and Clark Expedition, as we call it today, in its time was known as the Corps of Discovery. And basically it was doing a survey of the entire Louisiana Purchase and beyond. In those days, nobody knew where the Missouri River source was. So they were the first Americans to go by land to the Pacific coast. President Jefferson wanted to do it very systematic. He wanted it properly surveyed. He was interested in everything, whether it was the soil, the plants, the birds, Native Americans. And that's why Lewis extended co-captaincy to William Clark, because their task was so great, they felt that it would require two officers to manage it all.
And just say a little bit about Lewis and Clark.
Meriwether Lewis came out to Western Pennsylvania as a young man from Albemarle County, Virginia, to crush the whiskey rebellion. He didn't think very highly of the rebels out here in Western Pennsylvania. He matriculated into the regular militia of the army at the time, was fighting Native Americans in Western Ohio. And using Pittsburgh as a headquarters, that's where William Clark was serving. William Clark was 4 years older than Meriwether Lewis, and he was then living in present-day Louisville, Kentucky, at the falls of the Ohio River. And it was in Pittsburgh that Lewis received the letter from Clark saying that he would join him on the expedition.
Now the National Historic Trail begins just north of St. Louis, and there's a move to create an Eastern Legacy Extension, which begins in Pittsburgh. Why should it start here?
Well, first I should say it's HR 3045, so we actually have a real bill with legal language that's sponsored from Congressman Luke Messer from Indiana. The existing trail now is about 3,700 miles that goes up the Missouri River, over the Rocky Mountains, and down the Snake River to the Columbia to the West Coast. And this would add on approximately just under 1,200 miles, the entire length of the Ohio River and about a little over 100 miles of the Mississippi River. The National Park Service did a 5-year study where they looked at 25 trail segments, all related to Lewis and Clark. But the National Park Service came to the conclusion, and I happen to agree with them, that those other sites don't rise to the level of the criteria that you would need to have a National Historic Trail. And they felt that Pittsburgh, this is where Captain Lewis first took troops under his command. This is where he started to make observations about the river and the shallows of the water. And this was the building, the launching of the flagship keelboat. This was a large 55-foot long barge, if you will, that would carry the majority of the supplies. This was considered the beginning of the expedition. And it's also a manageable segment too. This would connect directly to the existing trail.
Can you point out where the events took place?
Sure. As we stand up here looking to the east, you can see the sloping roof of the David Lawrence Convention Center, which was on the site of the fifth fort that was in downtown Pittsburgh, Fort Fayette. And that is where we believe that the keelboat was commissioned, built, and launched August 31st, 1803. And then as the Allegheny River connects with the Monongahela River and the Ohio River starts, we can see that graceful curve arching right in front of us. And to the west is a beautiful view of Bruno's Island, which was the first landing of the keelboat. So basically, from this one spot, you can see the first 3 miles of the Lewis and Clark expedition as it goes to the west.
Without Bruno Island, McNulty says the Pittsburgh connection might not even be that well known. There's a small power plant there now. But during the 1803 landing, an incident with a revolutionary piece of equipment, an air rifle, caused Lewis to write about it in his journal.
A Mr. Blaise Senes, being unacquainted with the management of the gun, suffered her to discharge herself accidentally. The ball passed through the hat of a woman about 50 yards distant, cutting her temple about a fourth of the diameter of the ball. She fell instantly, and the blood gushing from her temple, we were all in the greatest consternation and supposed she was dead. But in a minute she revived, to our inexpressible satisfaction, and by examination we found the wound by no means mortal or even dangerous. The rivers were the highways, And the Mississippi watershed provided this incredible access into the interior of the continent. Only about 5% of the expedition was truly on land, and that was crossing the Bitterroot Mountains down into the Columbia watershed. The trail, as it were, is the rivers. It's a water trail. And that's important because that brings people into greater awareness of how we need to protect our water systems and our creeks and feeder streams and everything else that's connected to water.
What do you think this extension would mean for Pittsburgh?
I think it would mean a great deal. We're talking about, you know, rebranding. We're still in the process of rebranding from the steel days. And now the word is out that Pittsburgh is a high-tech center. But I really feel that future sustainable economy can be based on the period of Pittsburgh's history before steel became king, when it was a glass manufacturing center, when it was a boat building center, when it was truly, as described by frontiersmen back in the day, the hills of Eden. It was a beautiful place. And I believe that this trail extension not only would set the historic record correctly, but it will encourage tourists around the nation to come and visit here for generations to come. This could be the catalyst for a lot of green infrastructure development. The bike trails that currently do not exist. There are no safe bike trails to get into the West End. And by us being the initial phase of this longest and arguably most famous National Historic Trail, we have to up our game. So things like bird sanctuaries, wonderful amenities, think what it could mean for the Upper Ohio watershed. Right now it's heavily industrialized. McKees Rocks, doesn't have like a boardwalk, but that could all change.
It's a big dream.
It is. It's something worth working on for a long time, and many people have been.
How do you square extending the trail to Pittsburgh, claiming Lewis and Clark for this region, with the other part of westward expansion, which is the taking of land from indigenous people and what happened to Native people after being violently forced into reservations, killed, disease?
It's not easy. You know, Jefferson said an empire of liberty. Big fan of Thomas Jefferson, but there's some inconsistencies just with that statement alone. An empire, by definition, means you're coercing somebody. I just think that if people would think about how we all got here, then there's many, many stories, many, many voices, and realize that they did not go into a wilderness is one of the other things that's always been, oh, they went into wilderness. The truth of the matter is William Clark, on his very accurate map, would write down an approximation of how many Native Americans were living in villages on their map. When our government published that map in 1814, they took out all that information to make it look like it was just out there for the taking. It was not. They relied on Native Americans throughout the entire expedition. They could not have done it without the support of Native Americans. The theme for me would be show respect for land and people and water.
John McNulty is a member of the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation, and they've gotten a grant to place a plaque near where we were standing to start setting the historical record straight about Western Pennsylvania's connection to the Lewis and Clark expedition. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.